This is Jim Engster coming today on the show. We will visit with the nationally regarded photographer Richard Sexton, who calls New Orleans home. His latest work is Creole World, Photographs of New Orleans in the Latin Caribbean Sphere. His work is on display at the Historic New Orleans Collection. And he began his career as a college student at Emory University in 1974, started in New Orleans, and went on to Bolivia with his camera in hand. And we will talk with Richard Sexton about his remarkable life and career. Also, there's a seven-letter word that we occasionally use, at least some of us do, when we refer to somebody and say, that guy's a real fill-in-the-blank. Aaron James has written a book, bestseller, called A-Holes, A Theory. We'll talk about it. Now the news. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We begin the week with one of the most decorated photographers in this part of the world, Richard Sexton. His latest work is Creole World, Photographs of New Orleans in the Latin Caribbean Sphere. Richard will be discussing his work tomorrow night, 5:30, at the Point Capi Historical Society on Main Street in New Roads, and he will also appear Sunday at the Ogden Museum in New Orleans. In Creole World, Richard Sexton explores the architectural and cultural connections between New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean, and he began his career 40 years ago as a college student at Emory University, and we will talk with him about then and now. Good morning, Richard Sexton.
Thanks for having me. Good to be chatting.
Good to talk with you. Let's go back to 1974 for a minute or two. You're, I guess, 20 years old, and you embark on your first photographic journey as a professional, and your first stop was New Orleans. What happened?
Well, that's right. Now, the New Orleans part of that trip, which was a very epic trip for a 20-year-old, because I decided to drive a Datsun station wagon all over Latin America. The station wagon got as far as Panama. I made it to Bolivia and back. But the first stop on that trip was a weekend in New Orleans. And we didn't have a lot of money, and we did what typical tourists do, walk down Bourbon Street, and we stayed in a pretty cheap hotel. I have to say, it was not a memorable way to start a relationship with New Orleans, but I did return to live in New Orleans in 1991, about 17 years after that South America trip, and that's when the pieces started to fall together.
Well, you're 20 years old. You had two other young people with you, and you're in this station wagon, and did you have any idea you'd go as far as Bolivia?
Well, I certainly had very grand ambitions for that trip, but what I really wanted to do is learn how to be a photographer. That was a big part of what was wrapped up in this dream. And I think that I came back from that trip a very different person, because I had learned a thing or two about photography, and I had seen the world. When I left for that trip, I had not traveled outside of, I grew up in southwest Georgia in a small little farming town. I had been to Florida, where we had relatives and would go to the beach, and I'd been to Alabama, and that was it.
And you started with the most rudimentary of equipment. It's amazing to look at those photographs, which are on display at the Historic New Orleans Collection. And what kind of a camera did you use?
Well, actually, it was a basic camera in terms of features and so forth, but it was a pretty refined camera. It was a German camera, Leica M4, and it's a legendary camera because the great French photographer Cartier-Bresson used one, and Sebastio Salgado, who's, I think, one of the greatest living photographers today, had used that camera. So the camera came with a lot of tradition, and I probably wasn't up to snuff at that point, but I think by the end of the trip, I was a lot better at it. But what is interesting, I think, is when you look at that equipment today, and it's in a case, boy, it looks like it's something from another century, and it is, because photography has completely changed in the 40 years or so that I've been doing photography. And now the technology is very, very different.
It is a remarkable body of work that Richard has accumulated over 40 years, and it all began on this trip with a basic camera, and those photographs, as stated, are on display at the Historic New Orleans Collection right now. Are you surprised when you look back and see those photographs and appreciate how good they are?
Well, I think I appreciate the fact that they have withstood the test of time pretty well. Of course, for me, they have this special place because it was my first really serious attempt at photography. And looking at those images and then the newer work, and to clarify for the listeners, the work on the walls is all from about an eight-year span starting in 2006, and it's all color and done with much more modern equipment. On a big video display is a looped slideshow of the black and white work from 1974, and some of that work is also in the preface that I wrote to Creole World, the book. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting comparison to see the early grainy black and white work from 1974 and then the more contemporary work. And what's interesting for me is you can sort of see I never changed the way I photographed. In 40 years, I was kind of doing the same thing, but in color instead of black and white and with very different equipment.
Well, moving from Atlanta to New Orleans on that trip, you say your first stop was at a hotel. It wasn't the Roosevelt or the Mont Lyon, was it?
Far from it, I'm afraid. It was Flophouse on St. Charles Street. It was all we could afford. I think it was $8 a night at that time. And we were about the only people visiting. It was a residential hotel. And but it was what we could afford, and you could walk to the French Quarter from there.
And I think there's a photograph of it in your collection.
There is. Yeah. There's a photograph, interestingly enough. I took a photograph with a bare light bulb on a chain in the room with peeling paint and old Venetian blinds, and the room made such an impression on me, I photographed it. And that became my first published photograph just a few years later in a book that was done by Nexus. In Atlanta, it was called the Southern Ethic Catalog. So that was sort of an interesting relationship between that room where we stayed, and I actually got, was the only good photograph I took in New Orleans from that trip, I think, was the interior of that room.
297-5633, inkstershow@wrkf.org. If you'd like to talk to Richard Sexton, born in Atlanta, but now lives in New Orleans, and your love affair with the great city of New Orleans began, I guess, on this trip when you were 20 years old.
It did, I think. But that weekend was so focused on what was going to be happening at the border. And nobody else, by the way, of my two traveling companions wanted to stop in New Orleans. They wanted to get to Mexico as quickly as possible. And so I was a little bit distracted on that first trip. I would say that really my love affair with New Orleans began in 1991 when I moved here, and I actually moved from San Francisco. I was born in Georgia, went to school in Atlanta, and then moved to San Francisco. I started my career there. And so when I came to New Orleans, I was coming from San Francisco. And I worked on a book, but as soon as I landed, and that became the book that sort of put me on the map in this neck of the woods, and that was New Orleans, Elegance and Decadence, which we just celebrated the 20th anniversary of the publication of that book, and it's still in print and still selling, and thank goodness for it, because it made a lot of other projects possible.
And there have been other books since then, including Creole World, Photographs of New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean Sphere, a beautiful book, and in fact, one of the essays that's in the book featured prominently is by former LSU professor Jay Edwards. And a listener asks about New Roads and Old Rivers. That was a book from a few years ago. I know you got great plaudits for your work with that, and I would imagine that'll be a topic tomorrow night when you're in Pointe-Coupee Parish.
Yes, I think it will be. I mean, everybody in Pointe-Coupee sort of knows me for, well, they were familiar with some of my earlier work from New Orleans, but New Roads and Old Rivers was a book that I did that was exclusively about Pointe-Coupee Parish. And so there'll be a lot of comparisons because Pointe-Coupee is a very Creole place. And so looking at the Latin Caribbean sphere, there's a lot of relationships up there with the folks in New Roads and in Pointe-Coupee Parish as well.
All right. 297-5633. Kevin asks, what prompted the move from San Francisco to New Orleans? I would imagine your creative life was certainly stimulated in the Bay Area. Why New Orleans?
Well, that's sort of a complicated question, I think. There were a lot of reasons, a lot of little reasons, and a couple of big ones. I think that in an almost Calvinist sort of way, when I moved to California, I felt like, well, I'm going to be a Southern expatriate. I'm not going to come back to the South. I thought I was moving away from the South for good. But to sort of hedge the bet, I always said, well, if I ever move back to the South, I'm going to move to New Orleans because that's the one place in the South that I felt like, well, it's not really Southern. It's this little exotic island within the South. And so when, for a variety of these reasons, I decided I was going to leave California, and it was a lot of practical reasons that were driving it, too. I had two small children. San Francisco is one of these places. It's a very big city, a very expensive place to live. And I just felt like I wanted to slow things down a bit. And so without any prior history, without any relatives in New Orleans or anything else or even a job, moved to New Orleans in 1991.
And since then, you have become one of the great authorities on New Orleans architecture, maybe the supreme one. And I see a list of your choices for the most prominent architecture, at least as far as eye-catching and historically significant. And a bit of surprise, the first place on your list, the Mercedes-Benz Superdome.
Yes. Well, I don't know how much of a surprise that might be. It's certainly the most familiar building to anybody that maybe doesn't live in New Orleans but sees the city in various ways through the media. The Superdome is a very significant piece of architecture. And it's also played a very important part in modern-day New Orleans. When you think about all the things that have happened there and how it is such a focal point, so I think it's for that reason. It's also, I think, if you think about architecture for a second as the big ideas that are behind it, that was a huge idea for New Orleans. When I first visited on that 1974 trip, the Superdome was under construction. And that did make an impression because it was there was a lot of mystique behind it. It was going to be the largest enclosed sports facility. It had transformed. The construction of that building really transformed the area around it. And so It was a very big idea, and New Orleans was going to compete with Houston and Atlanta and all the rest. And I think that's the reason that I chose it, because it's not just a very significant piece of architecture aesthetically, but what it means to the city.
Richard Sexton is our guest for a bit longer, if you'd like to join the conversation. Anywhere you are, 877-217-5757, or you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Richard's latest work, Creole World, Photographs of New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean Sphere, is out and about, and Richard will be in New Roads tomorrow night. And we shall return after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett is producing. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. Inkster Show, WRK at WRKF.org, works online. Richard Sexton is in New Roads tomorrow night, and he will be discussing his latest work and others. His latest is Creole World, and it is a majestic book, Photographs of New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean Sphere, and we will get to that in short order. But listener Trudy wanted to know some of the other buildings on Richard's list of the greatest architecture in New Orleans, and as noted in the first segment, Richard says, Rome has its Colosseum, New Orleans has its Superdome, which is easily the biggest, boldest thing New Orleans has accomplished architecturally in the modern era. And to put it in perspective, the Astrodome is no longer in use in Houston, and it preceded the Superdome, and other dome stadiums have gone, by the way, including the King Dome in Seattle. But the Superdome, next year, will be 40 years old, and Richard was a young man, 20 years old, when he made his first photographic journey, and the New Orleans Superdome, which has become the Mercedes-Benz Superdome, was under construction at the time. But your number two building, Richard, is a house on Claiborne Avenue. Tell us about this.
I think that wasn't that a house on Carondelet?
I thought it was on Claiborne, but I may be wrong.
No, it's a house. It's a wonderful house. It's on Claiborne in Washington, actually, and it was built by a fellow, and I'm sorry, I don't know his name, but he had an iron foundry, and so it's really got some of the most elaborate cast iron work in New Orleans. And what's unusual is its setting. It was in what was a very grand neighborhood in its day, but it's across St. Charles, lakeside of St. Charles, from the Garden District, and so that neighborhood has not fared as well as the Garden District below or on the riverside of St. Charles. And now the building is apartments, and so it's a kind of ironic present for the building, and it had a much more glorious past. But it is one of those vestiges of when that neighborhood and that building specifically was grander and wealthier.
Who was the original owner?
I don't know. I don't know the name. Although it is known, I don't happen to know it.
Well, you also make reference to Markey's Bar.
Yes. I think one of the most charming aspects of New Orleans, and this is more or what the bar represents rather than its qualities as a work of architecture. Those corner commercial buildings, which were frequently bars, or they were groceries or cafes sometimes, they were such an important part of New Orleans neighborhoods, and they were a focal point for the community, and everybody had a local bar in their neighborhood. And that's kind of a tradition that we've lost over time. And Markey's Bar is still, through all the ups and downs of Bywater and the Ninth Ward, Markey's Bar has endured. And it's as popular now as it ever was. And I always go there on St. Patrick's Day to see the downtown Irish parade.
Well, your book, as I stated, is quite a work of art. And it's chock full of the spectacular photography of Richard Sexton, not only of New Orleans, but for the whole Latin Caribbean sphere. And it starts shotgun houses, vibrant street scenes, grand villas and mansions, colorful facades. They're all part of a historically rich, interconnected Creole world. New Orleans is often hailed for its distinctive Creole heritage, evident in its food, its architecture, its people, but it is far from alone. The Creoleness may be unique to the United States, but New Orleans is part of an entire family of Latin Caribbean cities with similar colonial histories. And you have worked from several locations.
Yes. What I really wanted to do with the book is to show in a very simple, straightforward, accessible way how similar New Orleans is to so many places in the Caribbean and in Latin America. New Orleans is a unique city when the context is North America. But once that context flips and changes, you see that it is much more of a typical city. And that's what I wanted to show. We all know that adage, New Orleans is the northernmost Caribbean city. Well, I wanted to show what that was like.
You definitely do it. Outside of New Orleans, what is your favorite city in the Latin Caribbean sphere?
Well, there are several. I would have to say that, you know, depending on how you define favorite, I think the one place that is the most similar to New Orleans is Cartagena, Colombia. And it is similar in so many ways. I mean, the architecture, the climate, the setting, the present-day ambiance of the city, which it's like New Orleans, it's become something of a resort destination. And it just has so many parallels. I think also Santiago de Cuba is a place almost exactly the same size as New Orleans with an awful lot of similarities between the two. And Cienfuegos in Cuba has a very important relationship because it was founded by French from Louisiana, Creoles from Louisiana who left after the purchase, and also immigrants from Bordeaux. And the founder, Clouet, Louis de Clouet, had a long relationship in Louisiana, and he served the Spanish crown in Louisiana. So that's a setting that has very, very many close connections historically. I would also say Cap Haitian would be my last city that I would specifically name for its striking similarity to New Orleans. There's street scenes in Cap Haitian where the architecture, everything about the place, you would think, you know, am I not in the French Quarter? And you're not. You're in another place several hundred miles away, but strikingly similar.
In your book, you have some fabulous photographs from Havana. How many times have you been there?
Well, I was only in Cuba once for this project, and I was there for a month, and I was traveling all over, and I was in several days in Havana, and, you know, I would certainly mention Havana in this list of other cities. The one thing about Havana is it was so much of a bigger, grander city in its day than New Orleans. So that aspect of it is a little bit dissimilar in a way because it is a bigger place. And again, some very striking similarities to New Orleans. And it's frequently compared. There's a great Liebling quote from the Earl of Louisiana where he was remarking on the similarity. And he specifically compared it to New Orleans in his writing to Havana and to Port-au-Prince.
Mm-hmm. Well, the old cars are still there.
They still are, yes. Uh-huh. And one of the favorite features of Havana today is the streetscapes with the old American cars all over the place. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a photograph in Creole World, and one thing that I learned while I was down there is that the Cuban government employs tourism operatives. Even the cars that don't run, they move them around in different places, and putting them in picturesque settings for the tourists to look at.
What's the deal with the shoes on the wire?
Okay, this is what I was told, and I was told by two different sources that you're referring to a photograph of a streetscape in Havana where there's a bunch of athletic shoes and other shoes that are tossed up on a power line that's in the composition. And I was told that for soccer games, championship games, the losing team had to throw their shoes up on the wire and then they would have to play the next game barefoot or with new shoes. That was a penalty for losing the big game. They would have to give up their shoes.
297-5633 for Richard Sexton, one of the top photographers in the world today. He calls New Orleans home. His latest work is Creole World, Photographs of New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean Sphere. Paul Anopoulosis, good morning. You're on the air with Richard Sexton. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Jim. Mr. Sexton, on the technical side, you can just ask two questions for me. What's your favorite camera now, and film versus digital? And I'll take my answer up there, and I will be in New Roads tomorrow. Thank you.
Oh, well, I'll look forward to seeing you in New Roads, Paul. I would say, actually, I'm using my primary camera now is the digital version of that Leica M4 film camera that I used way back in 1974. I've come around sort of full circle and am now using equipment that's as similar as it could be to the equipment that I was using then, apart from the fact that it's digital. And I still shoot film. I shoot it relatively rarely. I more frequently shoot black and white than color when I do. And I have to say that there are pluses and minuses to all this digital stuff. It certainly makes some things easier. And when I think about a project like Creole World and the cost and the difficulties of shooting a project like that on film, I'm very thankful for digital when I think about that. But I have to say I do miss, for 30 years of my career in photography, it was all about film. And I really failed to foresee just how quickly everything was going to change. I wish I could have had some more of a premonition about that. And because, you know, like they say, I mean, you miss these things once they're gone, and they're not a part of the landscape in the way that they once were. So that's kind of my summation of the film and digital thing. I mean, there's just no going back now. Digital is the currency for still photographic images going forward, and it's what we have to work with.
As a resident of New Orleans, what's your perception, Richard, on the crime that is pervasive in the city? As we know, last week there was a shooting of multiple people on Bourbon Street. What's going on?
Well, I think I would respond to that this way. I think that if you look not just at New Orleans, but you look at the entirety of the Creole world and beyond that, for that matter, it's an imperfect world, and things aren't, there are a lot of underlying reasons for why this is happening. And I think that in New Orleans, like so many big cities, crime is a problem, and it's actually an historical problem. I mean, it's been with us for decades, where the inner-city neighborhoods have a higher crime level than they should have. And it certainly, when it happens in those unfortunate situations, it's devastating, and it's big news, because it is such devastating news. And I wish I had a solution for it, and I don't. Mm-hmm. But it's just one of those tragic things that is it's the fly in the ointment, so to speak.
No book of New Orleans photography would be complete without some photographs of the cemeteries. And you certainly capture the St. Louis Cemetery Number 1 in all its glory.
Thank you. Yes, I love cemeteries. They are such a wonderful repository of history. And they never get, well, I take this back. I mean, Girard Cemetery isn't with us anymore. Speaking of the Superdome, that was one of the casualties of that project, as we lost the oldest Protestant cemetery in the city. But when the cemeteries do survive, they really are this intact thing that slowly evolved over time. And you can go back in time. As you see, there are people that are recently deceased who are interred there, and then you go back in time to hundreds of years ago. And you look at the names and the histories of all these families and the architectural styles, because the tombs are quite grand. And it really is like a necropolis. It is a city in and of itself. And in New Orleans, the cemetery is one of the great treasures. They're full of history, and they're beautiful.
Hugh at LSU. Hugh, you're on with Richard Sexton.
Oh, listen, I'm enjoying your discussion, and I hope to get over to New Roads tomorrow night. Let me ask you a question about, were you in the New Orleans area right after Katrina?
I was.
Were you there?
Did you?
Go ahead, Hugh.
No, I was just going to remark in terms of photography that some of those shots down even at in the warehouse area, but near the dome, were sadly like Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Yes, I mean, I think that one of the underlying histories of the Creole world is it's a story of trial and tribulation and reversal of fortune. Places like Havana and Port-au-Prince that were once fabulously wealthy places are not so much so today. New Orleans has actually been far more fortunate than most in that regard. But still, New Orleans isn't rivaling New York anymore either. So its place in history and the history of American cities has been adjusted somewhat in the modern age. But, I photographed in Haiti post-earthquake. Their tragedy happened in 2010, 5 years after Katrina. And they have had a great deal of difficulty recovering from that. And when people ask me about Haiti today, I tell them, well, you remember those first couple of weeks after Katrina? It's been like that for them for 4 years. So, there are some unfortunate similarities in that regard. And I have to say, when I was traveling in Haiti and photographing there, I saw so many things that reminded me of the immediate aftermath of Katrina.
Richard Sexton is the photographer, one of the world's best, and he will be in the lovely hamlet of New Roads tomorrow at 5:30 at the Pointe Coupee Historical Society. That's at 500 West Main Street. Also at the Ogden Museum on the Sunday the 13th. A question from John in New Roads, and I think I know the answer. As far as your book, will copies be available for sale at your event tomorrow evening?
Yes, certainly. They will be for sale.
And I'm sure Richard will be happy to sign them.
Absolutely.
As well. And we'll spend a few more minutes with Richard and also hear from Aaron James, who's written a provocative book, a national bestseller. And it is called A-Holes, and I am shortening the actual title, A Theory. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Back to wrap it up with the remarkable Richard Sexton. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Richard Sexton with us for a few more minutes, and if you'd like to extend the conversation, Richard will be at the Pointe Coupee Historical Society tomorrow night, 5:30 in lovely New Roads. And his book, New Orleans and the Latin Caribbean Sphere, is a spectacular book of photography. And it has shots of New Orleans and other great Caribbean places. And what a wonderful shot you have of the Superdome in the book. And usually when we see photographs of the Superdome, it's exclusively the Superdome. But you've got the neighborhood, and it is curious that there is a neighborhood not so far away from...
Oh, it's immediately adjacent, in fact. I photographed it. I would describe it as a backdoor view of the Superdome. And you'll see that a lot in Creole world. I tend to photograph through the back door a lot because it's juxtaposition of inner city neighborhood, central city. And there's the Superdome sort of looming in the background. It's a striking juxtaposition and one that I would see in many places in the Creole real world, where you see the past colliding with the present in a really dramatic way.
297-5633, and I'd like to get at least one more, maybe two people on with Richard. Denise in South Downs. Denise, good morning. You're on with Richard Sexton.
Hi Richard. I heard you say you love for cemeteries in Pascagoula on Krebs Lake by the old Spanish Fort. And there is a very old cemetery there that has some beautiful headstones that are quite ancient, it seems to me. And also they've been the hurricane.
All right, that's Pascagoula, Mississippi. That's probably not a place where you usually go, but
I pass through quite a bit, and it's actually interesting. You know, there are. In fact, I was just in Mobile for an event for Creole World, people don't realize that they have in Mobile they have a Creole history that they're very proud of, and the French were there and discovered Mobile Bay and first settled it, and. It was the capital of the Louisiana Territory at one point. So all along the Gulf Coast, you see little bits and pieces. Now, the one thing that I will say, just because I couldn't do a whole encyclopedic work, I really couldn't get into all these other little places, including even Pointe Coupee, which is a very Creole place. It was just New Orleans. I had to limit it to New Orleans only, and then comparing that with all of these other places. But you will find little bits and pieces of French and Spanish colonial history and the cultural impact of that sprinkled all over the Gulf Coast.
Well, thank you, Richard. And remember, tomorrow night, 5:30, Pointe Coupee Historical Society, Main Street, New Roads. Richard Sexton will be there. He'll also be at the Ogden Museum on Sunday in New Orleans.
And Sunday at 2:30, yes.
2:30. And his work is on display as we speak at the Historic New Orleans Collection on, is that Charters? Is it on Charters?
It's at 400 Charters Street, which is at Conti, right next to the Williams Research Center.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Our pleasure. And now we're joined by Aaron James, a provocative writer who has tackled what does it mean for someone to be a fill-in-the-blank. Now, when he was on American Public Media, the host referred to the title of the book as Ethel's rather than saying the actual name. I think we can go as far as saying a-holes, a theory. What makes somebody this kind of a person, Aaron?
Hi, yeah, nice to be with you. So the a-hole or Ethel, if you want to call it that, is the guy, and usually they're men, mainly men, not only, who, as I think of it, takes special advantages in cooperative life. So maybe cuts in line or talks too loud on a cell phone or parks in a handicapped space without, you know, a permit, and then does those things from a sense of entitlement. You know, maybe he thinks he's special because he's rich or because he's especially smart or has a general sense of superiority. And then where he does those things, because he feels entitled, he's unwilling to listen to the complaints of other people. So if he cuts in line and you say, hey, buddy, there's a line here, he just says, you know, piss off.
Well, what's the dividing line, Aaron, between, say, an Ethel and just a jerk? There is a dividing line, isn't there, somewhere?
Yeah, I think of the difference as a difference in whether they'll apologize. So the jerk might be insensitive and do lots of things that an Ethel will do, but they will apologize. So they say, you know, I'm sorry, I was such a jerk. They might keep doing the same things, you know, so they can be an incorrigible jerk, but they don't have the sense of entitlement that makes them feel like they don't need to apologize. The Ethel, by contrast, really believes that they're entitled to the special benefits they take, so they don't see anything to apologize for.
297-5633. I'm sure some of us have encountered Ethels on occasion, and maybe some of us are Ethels, but you say generally it's men. Why aren't women Ethels?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think that it's mostly because men and women are socialized very differently. So men are given a lot of leeway as children to sort of act out. Boys will be boys, that kind of thing. Whereas girls, when they act out, they're sharply sanctioned. You know, we don't tolerate, you know, non-cooperative behavior in girls in many cases. You know, and parents often do that, you know, thinking, you know, that no one will marry the girl or whatever, you know, if she's acting out too much. Whereas, you know, boys will be boys. It can be, if they're assertive or not so responsible, you kind of don't expect more. So I think socialization explains a lot of the difference.
And what do we do when we encounter somebody like this? Perhaps they're a boss, and it's not like we can just move away from them. Or if we do, there's a cost. How do we handle Ethels?
Yeah, so I think this is a very difficult. One of the first things to see is just that it's an inherently very difficult problem. So, the idea is that the a-hole deprives you of recognition as an equal because they're unwilling to listen to your reasonable complaints. And so we tend to want to lash out in a fit of rage to get the person to listen, or just feel depressed because we know they won't listen, you know, and sort of despondent. So the first thing you can do is just appreciate that it's an intrinsically difficult problem, and so go easy on yourself when, you know, you have a hard time with it. But then more concretely, you know, things you can do, things like avoid them, as you know, even at a significant cost. Like if you have the option of changing a job, you know, to avoid an a-hole boss, then maybe you would do that, even if you had to take a pay cut. That's not realistic for most people, I don't think. So we do have to just learn to manage to deal with them. And then from there, there's a lot of specific things you can do. One of them, for example, is just to be clear in yourself that a wrong is a wrong, and not by the Ethel's view of the world, that, you know, in which he's entitled to sort of mistreat you in various ways. Other things you can do are, like, make a polite request for a very specific thing, because even if you can't be assured that the guy will listen, you know, maybe he'll make the change, so it's worth the effort. And also you can form a Ethel support group, so it's very important to find some way of having your status as an equal recognized without expecting the Ethel to listen or change. So you can do that on your own by protesting what the Ethel does without expecting him to listen or change. You could do that for the eyes of others or for yourself. You could stick up, you know, for a group in a protest. You can form an Ethel support group, things like that.
The book is A-Holes, A Theory, and we're calling them Ethels. The Los Angeles Review of Books says, convincing, funny, Aaron James makes a rigorous case for why we should take the problem of the a-hole seriously. Now, historically, you note that Ernest Hemingway was an a-hole of great magnitude, wasn't he?
Yeah, I guess I do think of him that way. I mean, he's an interesting case of the Ethel artist, or a-hole artist, who really was, you know, a tremendous artistic talent. But then, you know, sort of, and maybe to some extent deserves special privileges because, you know, great artists, you know, need a creative opportunity to flourish, but then went too far with it, right, with, you know, things like womanizing or rudeness and things like that. So sort of characteristic pattern there with Picasso, for example, and other great artists.
Let's go down a list, and some of these have been provided by listeners, and we welcome your input, 297-5633. Donald Trump, is he an a-hole?
I think he is, although he borders, interestingly, on what you might call an ass clown, which is sort of somebody who's kind of a buffoon-like character. You know, he's not totally aware of the fact that he sort of makes himself seem silly, but there is sort of a humorous quality to him. So sometimes you can see him as just of that type and not a proper a-hole, as I would put it. But I think he does also qualify, if only because he really does believe he's entitled to, you know, say a lot of the things he says that are, you know, if not just unwise, but often just, you know, inappropriate.
Ann Coulter, is she an Ethel?
Yes, I think she is. She's an interesting example of a woman who seems to count as an Ethel. I mean, because of her intentionally saying things that are rude and provocative, and maybe you could see it as just a kind of publicity stunt. But I think she's sort of gone beyond that in a way that's, well, I don't know, characteristically male, really. So she sort of crossed over gender lines in some sense.
Anthony Weiner.
I think he is, just because of, well, it was a humiliating kind of apology with his wife next to him, which was a kind of an apology, not an apology, when he was, apologizing about the text or the sex kind of behavior. He didn't seem that sorry, or maybe more sorry to have gotten caught, or kind of thing. He created this display that it was humiliating for his wife. That seemed unacceptable. She sort of dealt with it as a trooper, but it seemed like he didn't show a lot of regard for her.
You know, a listener notes that Ethels quite often mate with very nice people, perhaps because they would kill each other if they mated with someone like themselves. But then there's Kim Kardashian and Kanye West. How's that one
going? They found each other.
How's that one going?
Yeah. I'm not sure what their relationship is like. It's still early on, and who knows if it'll last. But I definitely do especially Kanye West. He's a fairly world-class a-hole in my book. In the book and in my books, in the world sense, in my view. And then together, I don't know, maybe together they're sort of using each other for publicity to some extent, and maybe they're excited about each other now. And it'll be interesting to see if they can make it last very long. It's hard to say.
And they have reproduced, so does that mean the kid is automatically going to be an Ethel?
Well, I think often, Ethels are a chip off the old block, and they learn what they know from their father. So that could be the case, but, kids are fairly resilient, and sometimes they rebel against their parents, and their kid, who knows, could rebel into decency. And I guess it could go that way just as well,
right,
too.
Politically, here are a few. John Boehner, is he an Ethel?
I don't think he is as much. I don't think he's as clear. I mean, he seems to me caught between political cross currents in the Republican Party in a pretty difficult way. And I don't see him as. I see him as more sort of compromising. And I don't know if he has flaws, and maybe it's some sort of cowardice or of a certain kind.
What about the president?
I don't think he is. I know that some people see him as smug, that he believes he's superior to other people. And he did definitely seem that way during one part of the debates. He seemed like he had it all coming, the next election with Romney, and that he didn't have to earn the re-election in the eyes of voters. That's the moment I think that was the most Ethel-ish. But overall, I think that he really does want people to cooperate, and he wants to do his part as he understands it. And mostly he's sort of upset that other people are just not willing to be more cooperative, that, right, mostly defiant to do anything that would be seen as cooperation and things like that. So on balance, I don't think he is.
The book is A-Holes, A Theory. Aaron James, it was an overwhelming bestseller in hardback, now available in paperback. And Aaron is a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Irvine. And a question from a listener who knows about your background: are there more or less Ethels in academia?
I think there are more than other areas of life. You might put academia as one of the areas that's sort of up there, with, or maybe not quite as bad as Hollywood or Wall Street or something like that. But there does seem to be a way in which we produce a fair number of them. I don't know, maybe it's because people lose perspective on sort of the practical problems with the rest of the world or things like that, get a kind of obsessive about status comparisons within academia. Very small differences in sort of rank and status start to motivate people way too much, and you know, some people just get carried away in that way.
Well, thank you for joining us, Professor Aaron James, who's written a book that is both serious and a bit lighthearted, and it is A-Hole's A Theory. Dr. James, good to visit with you.
Thank you very much.
Take care, and we shall hopefully talk again soon.
Cheers.
And we shall return tomorrow. For Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to WRKF, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.